charge the people a dollar and a half just to see them. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. Farmer, put away the DDT now. Give me spots on my apples, or leave me the birds and the bees. Please, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They pay paradise, put up a parking lot. Late last night, I heard the screen door slam. Big yellow taxi took away my old man. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? We paid paradise, put up a parking lot. I said, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? We paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
This is KZFR 90.1 in Chico, and you are listening to Ecotopia, a weekly program exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological.
Tonight we'll be talking with Aaron Meason, the Vice President, Chief Sustainability Officer for Interface. It's a commercial flooring company which in 1994 pledged to reduce its negative impact on the environment with Mission Zero. And we'll remind you that the opinions voiced on this program do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. We'll take a short break. We'll be back to talk with Aaron Meason. You're listening to Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico.
Just begun
is Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 in Chico. And with us by phone now is Erin Mizan. She is the Vice President and Chief Sustainability Officer for Interface, a commercial flooring company which in 1994 pledged to reduce its negative impact on the environment with Mission Zero. Erin leads a global team that provides technical assistance and support to the company's global business, addressing sustainability at all levels, from operations and management to employees and customers, and in policy forums. Interface has evolved to thinking to its thinking to go beyond doing less harm in creating positive impacts, not just for Interface and the flooring industry, but the letters in this script are too small. The flooring industry, but for the world at large.
We're going to have a lot of questions about the flooring industry, but we'll tell you that in 2016, Erin led the company to unveil Climate Take Back to tackle global climate change. This mission is focused on creating a path for Interface and others to reverse global warming, not just reduce carbon emissions. Erin Mizan is also an advisor for Project Drawdown. That's a research organization that reviews, analyzes, and identifies the most viable global climate solutions and shares those findings with the world. She'll be a keynote speaker, this is very important, folks, at This Way to Sustainability on the Chico State Campus. She'll be here on Friday, March 27th, 9 to 10 a.m. Welcome, Erin Mizan.
Mizan.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. First of all, we don't do interviews with people like you very often, so this is really interesting to me. Tell us a little bit about Interface, what it is, what it does, and what your role is at Interface.
Sure. Well, Interface is a billion-dollar American flooring manufacturer, and it started out almost 50 years ago in a really cool way. It was founded by an American engineer who saw a really cool product in Europe, which was this modular carpet, and he thought, this is one of the most innovative things I've ever seen. You know, not just a roll of carpet or a rug, but these squares and shapes that would kind of allow me and designers to build the offices of the future. So our founder, Ray Anderson, saw this amazing product, decided to bring it to the U.S. and built a billion-dollar company around it. So Interface now not just makes only that kind of modular carpet, but we also sell really cool rubber flooring that goes everywhere from operating rooms to subways. And the most important thing that we do is not just make really cool, innovative products, but try to make them in the most environmentally and socially responsible way. So my job as the Chief Sustainability Officer is to decide what the vision of the company should be on sustainability, and then help the business come up with plans to implement that and ultimately find ways to make sure those environmentally and socially responsible products are favored by our customers.
Tell us, please, a little more about the flooring itself. I've had adventures in Pergo-type flooring, installed it myself. Not well. And we've recently had a look at some flooring that looks like photographic reproductions of flooring on something that used to be linoleum, but now it's something else. So this is not what you're doing. So I'd be really eager to hear about it.
Yeah, so we sell a couple of different types of things. The first is modular carpet, which is largely made from recycled nylon as the fluffy part of the face. And largely different recycled materials that make up the backing. And what's so cool about modular flooring is, it has a really great sustainability story, not just in the materials that are used to manufacture it, but also in its use. So if you imagine like a hotel room, and one thing that commonly happens when people spend the night in a hotel is they fill a glass of wine or actually put the iron on the floor.
Mm-hmm. I've actually
right?
done
it
that.
It happens all the time. Or if you're at home, you're in a nursery, you're, in your dining room and someone spills a glass of wine, what typically happens is it could ruin your entire rug, your entire installation. what's really cool about the functionality of modular flooring is you can actually pick up that square of carpet, wash it off, attempt to save it, and if it's not at all salvageable, just end up replacing one piece versus an entire kind of rug or an entire room. So not only kind of during the manufacture is it kind of a really smart, sustainable product, but actually in its function. I've had Interface products in my house for about 15 years, and I've got a couple dogs. I've got friends who like to spill wine. It just kind of really works on the carpet tile side. And we find that that's great from a kind of design and sustainability perspective. We also make really cool vinyl flooring. And that vinyl flooring, some of what you're talking about, where people are sort of printing images on flexible flooring, that vinyl flooring category is the fastest growing category in the flooring business right now. And what a lot of our customers said to us a couple of years ago was, we really appreciate Interface's ethos around sustainability. Why don't you enter this category and attempt to change it? And so vinyl flooring, when we started selling it a couple of years ago, was not the most environmentally friendly flooring. And we've done a couple of really interesting things in the business to try to change that. And we just announced a couple weeks ago that we've now worked with our supplier so that 39% of the flooring, the vinyl flooring that we sell, now comes from recycled content.
That's
so great. That was just with one project. We see ourselves being able to, in the next iteration of sustainability of those products, not just increase the recycled content to like 80%, but what that does for a product in the flooring category, but also elsewhere, is that when you're able to use recycled materials, it deeply reduces the carbon footprint of the product. So once we make this next iteration from like 40% recycled to 80% recycled, we'll actually cut the carbon footprint of those products in half.
Wow, nice.
Yeah, so it's super exciting. Flooring doesn't seem like it's the most fascinating dinner conversation, but let me tell you, there's some amazing stuff happening in terms of new materials, ability to recycle them, you know, carbon neutral products. There's really exciting stuff going on.
I have a trivial story. At the Chico Peace and Justice Center, I was doing iron-on t-shirt transfers for a protest of some sort, left the iron on the floor, and of course burned the carpet, and it's still there because we can't afford to replace the carpet. We could have used replaceable squares.
Right? It's just so smart.
How did Interface get into the sustainability business in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, it started with a question from a customer. It was really our customers who drove us that way. And interestingly, it was a customer in California. One of the early green buildings was being built in the early 1990s, and the architect was working to sort of, you know, specify certain products to go into this kind of environmentally sustainable building. And they asked our sales team, you know, we love the kind of functionality of this, and we understand kind of the materials, but what is your company doing for the environment? And it was never a question that Interface had asked itself in the first 25 years of the company. And we lost that project. And it got back to our CEO, Ray Anderson, at the time. And, you know, he said, well, we need to figure out how to answer this question for customers. And that touched off kind of a journey at the company where he was asked to give a speech. He didn't know what to say. He had no environmental vision. He read a book by Paul Hawken called The Ecology of Commerce. And he had what he described as an epiphanal experience. It fundamentally opened his eyes to kind of the damage that business had done to the natural world. But it made him optimistic that because business was powerful, innovative, had a lot of money, that business could actually reverse the trend, and he was committed to start Interface on that path.
Wow. And it's continued. He's not the CEO. He's old.
Yes. But surprisingly, you know, he had this epiphany when he was 60 years old in 1994, and he led the company in this journey for about 5 or 6 years as CEO. Then he stepped down, remained the chairman of our board of directors, and was actively involved in the business until he passed away in 2011.
Wow.
So he was with us on a good part of the journey. And certainly was our inspiration, was our biggest cheerleader, and he helped Interface in the very early days really figure out how to apply this to a business, because he was kind of both things. He was a businessman who had built this billion-dollar company, but he became the person who had the epiphany. He created this idea of Mission Zero, and he set the company on this path to have zero negative impact. But then he smartly sort of started recruiting people to help us, because as he says, you know, he had no idea about anything related to sustainability, and he certainly didn't know how to apply it to a business. So Paul Hawken was the first person that he reached out to, and he actually, back in the old days, actually wrote Paul a letter and said, "I'm the CEO of a billion-dollar company. I read your book. It changed my mind. I want to change my company. Will you please help me figure out how we can make Interface a more sustainable company and help me create this advisory team?" And then Paul started recruiting people like Amory Levin and Janine Benyus with Biomimicry 3.8. David Brower, who was, you know, the founder of the Sierra Club, right? Or sorry, its first executive director.
Yeah.
Like the rock stars of sustainability.
Wow.
And they were
amazing,
willing to help the company set the right mission, figure out how to measure it, and then really worked with us in the early days on projects. Like Amory Levin helped us really understand how to make a lot of the factories more efficient and how we could start to integrate renewable energy into the operations. Janine Benyus helped our product design team think about nature and natural systems and helped us like redesign our products in a way that had much less waste, were much more efficient. So all of these advisors really helped us get the mission off the ground in the early days.
Where are your factories located?
So we have 8 factories around the world, and our model for manufacturing is that we manufacture to the market where we sell. So we don't, you know, make something in Europe that gets sold in Texas.
Yeah.
So we have a large factory in Georgia in the United States. We've got 2 in Europe that are in Northern Ireland and Holland. And then we have a few more sprinkled around the Asia Pacific region in Australia, China, and Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have a rubber manufacturing factory in Germany.
Wow.
Yep.
It is huge, isn't it? So, you said a little bit about this at the beginning, and from what you just said now, I see this was truly visionary when they started planning this. It was kind of an unusual vision from the very beginning. It wasn't just, okay, let's fix this. It was a vision. And so how have things changed? You've been there for 15 years, or how long have you been there?
Yep, 15 years.
Uh-huh.
Well, it was interesting. It started out with this really bold vision to be a regenerative business. And we knew that in order to translate that and to make progress against that, we would need to set some really ambitious goals. So this idea of zero footprint was how we translated that in the early days.
Okay, yeah.
And then subsequent to that, that meant, okay, building in goals in all operations. So if we aspire to have a, you know, to be a company that has no negative impact, that means we have to have zero waste. It means we have to have zero carbon emission. It means we have to use renewable energy. We have to create a closed loop system for our materials, which means we have to use recycled materials and be able to recycle them on the back end. But all of that requires a management team and a bunch of factory employees and sales teams who actually understand what all of that means, are empowered to act on that. And sometimes we needed a whole bunch of advisors to help us get there. So, you know, in the early days, a lot of it was this kind of goal setting and a lot of learning and education in the company to even understand the concepts of sustainability. which is why that early advisory team was so helpful. But then the other part of it was really we had to empower people and give them permission to do business differently and to come up with new ideas. And so we did that by designing programs that were tied to those goals. So a great example is we said, the first thing we can do, what seems very simple and logical to all of us, is we can waste less, right? Mm-hmm. That's the first step to becoming more sustainable. So we put programs in place at the factory level where we started measuring how much we waste. And then we kind of empowered all the factory employees to come up with new ideas. And so we created a formal program where we asked for suggestions. We created factory level leadership teams that included people in different levels of management to submit their ideas. Then we, you know, gave people permission to pilot new ways of setting the machines to create less waste and to come up with more education programs. And then we measured it. And so, you know, this idea of sustainability, certainly in the beginning for us, was having the right goal. I would say we had a big moonshot goal, which was zero. But then in order to achieve that, just as much as there's technological innovation, there's a whole bunch of, like, human innovation that has to happen. And I think one of our lessons is you have to be equally focused on all the human things that have to happen. Getting people to understand the mission, educating them to kind of new concepts, creating that mindset shift that you need to have happen, giving people permission to try new things, measuring that, you know, then giving everyone a feedback loop about how things are going. And I think in what a lot of companies don't realize when they start this is they set the goals too low and they forget about the human side of change that needs to happen.
And it must be pretty exciting for people who do have that mindset to work in that sort of situation. If you don't have that mindset, it's tough to, I mean, it takes inspiration as well as education, I would think.
I wonder, go ahead.
Sorry, Ray used to have this saying that was like, you know, minds change one person at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah. I think you always have to be conscious of there are going to be people who are going to be inspired by a vision and be ready to go. And then there are going to be other people who you're going to need to convince. And in some of the early days of Interface, we'd have, you know, factory meetings where we'd be talking about what sustainability actually means. And people read books.
Cool.
You know, they read the biomimicry book. We were constantly bringing in outside speakers to talk to our factory teams on things like energy efficiency and biomimicry. And so I think, you know, it's providing the space for people to learn and to enter into the mission at their own pace was really important to ultimately getting us to change as many minds as we possibly could.
So
is this competitively sustainable in terms of the price of your product? Are you competitive? I'm thinking there's a lot of cheap flooring out there, some of which we put in our own home to our later regret. How do you do competitively, and is it cost effective to invest this kind of time and energy in your employees, your factories?
Sure, I'll take the first one. You know, our products are definitely priced competitively with other companies that, you know, make similar products. And
okay.
The reason they have to be is because a lot of our customers are not willing to pay very high premiums for sustainability. But I think the value proposition that we sell to customers when they, you know, are purchasing an Interface product, sustainability is only part of it. You know, we say to them, we can guarantee to you that we will give you the most sustainable product we know how to make right now, which typically means a high recycled content product that can be recycled at the end of its life and is carbon neutral as a standard attribute.
Nice.
That's nothing our competitors have,
right?
But that's just a part of it. We're also selling what we think are the best designed products with really great performance and functionality. So, you can't buy a super sustainable carpet tile, for example, that is carbon neutral that will last half as much as a competitor.
Yeah, right.
Doesn't look beautiful.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so we've found that we're able to do that. And I think it gets back to your other question, why we're able to do that is there were a lot of myths, and there still are, surrounding the ability to make more sustainable products. Mm-hmm. They have to be more expensive, that they won't perform as well, that they won't look, you know, as fantastic as some of the other less sustainably designed products. And we simply won't accept that.
Nice.
You know, when we put a product out in the marketplace, it has to be as sustainable as possible. It still has to be well designed, and it still has to have the performance. And we've been able to kind of debunk the myth that, you know, you have to take one of those away in order to have a more sustainable product. And the best example I can give you is, you know, the biggest environmental impact of making a carpet happens to be the nylon that goes into the face of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the place where we see kind of the biggest environmental impact in terms of the raw materials that are extracted to make that.
Mm-hmm.
When we first went back to our supply chain and said, we want to make really beautiful carpet tiles that have recycled nylon.
Mm.
And whichever one of our nylon suppliers, at the time there were four, whichever one of you can give us a recycled content nylon, we're going to go from giving you 25% of our business to a much bigger chunk of our business.
Mm.
So a couple of them started competing. Ultimately, we selected one of them, purchased recycled yarn from them. The following, and there was a bit of a premium. You know, it was a small premium that Interface paid that we didn't pass along to customers, because we knew that within the next couple of years, all four of them would be supplying recycled content, right?
Yeah.
Because once one of them cracked it, and they saw that they could get a market share from Interface, and their, you know, purchasing would actually go up, then a second supplier of ours actually said, oh, now we have recycled content nylon as well, which then enabled us to go back to the first supplier and say, look, we now have a competitor, and they're offering it at this price. We need to sort of get rid of the premium. And ultimately, over the course of 4 to 5 years, we deeply reduce the premium associated with recycled content. So we really disprove this idea that you can't sort of invest in recycled materials, you can't incorporate them into your products without passing that along to customers, because there really was a very short timeline of the premium that we were paying associated with recycled materials.
Wow. That lifts my spirit.
It does,
hearing
it does.
That.
I'm thinking of all those
World War II
nylon stockings.
That was a long time ago.
Long time ago.
2016, you introduced Climate Take Back, and I want to hear about what that was.
Sure. So in 2016, Interface, you know, celebrated this amazing kind of moment where we reflected, it had been 5 years since our founder passed away, and we said, you know, how are we doing on Mission Zero, and what do we really need to do next? What's the future of sustainability at the company? And, you know, we became convinced that given the numbers from the latest IPCC reports and what was happening in the built environment space, being, you know, 40% of the carbon emissions globally between building construction and building fit out, we really became convinced that as a manufacturer in that space and as a sustainability leader, we needed to increase the level of ambition that our company had on carbon. We needed to sort of go beyond this idea of zero carbon to say, how do we not just really increase our ambition and our mission focused on carbon in our company, but how do we encourage others in the built environment space? So Climate Take Back was our attempt to launch a new mission and to say Interface has a plan where we're going to go beyond just zero carbon emissions in our business. We're actually going to try to run the business in a way that it can be carbon negative by 2040.
Wow. And so how does that happen?
So you know, what we actually have to do is three things. We have to continue to put zero carbon emissions in the atmosphere, and we're not totally at zero yet. Interface has reduced the greenhouse gas emissions from our business on the operations side about 96% since we started. And it sounds like a whopping number, but for most companies that make products, the operational impact, you know, the energy that we use in our factories is actually not a huge part of that. It's really all the raw materials and their extraction, which causes, you know, the biggest carbon footprint. So we've been really good at reducing our own footprint. We've made some progress in our supply chain to have them reduce their footprint by asking for recycled materials, but we have to do more. I mean, we need to get to a place where Interface and our supply chain can say we've both reduced our emissions, you know, to essentially zero. We need to become a carbon neutral company first. And then on top of that, we need to find ways that we can remove carbon from the atmosphere, because the scientific community is saying to solve global warming, we need to do three really simple things. Stop putting more carbon in the atmosphere. Remove all the excess carbon that's up there through new technologies, through better agriculture, through everything that we can do. And then the third is we need to continue to kind of protect and then enhance all the natural sinks that exist on the planet already. Those forest lands, those savannas, the oceans. So as a business, we need to kind of think about climate that way. Not just the emissions of our factories, but how are we creating a business strategy that number one gets us to zero, number two helps remove carbon from the atmosphere, and number three does business in a way that continues to protect and enhance those things. So that doesn't sound like an easy translation and boring.
It sounds.
So the next question is like, well, how the heck does a carpet company or a company that makes rubber continue to do all that stuff? And the first is just, you know, continuing to run the operations in a way that produces zero carbon. That means getting to 100% renewable energy use at all of our factories, continuing to focus on energy efficiency, thinking about how our employees come to work. But then the second part, the removal part, is actually finding ways that our factories and our products can either use materials that draw carbon from the atmosphere, or find a way that we can have our buildings and our products actually act as carbon sinks.
You've answered my next question kind of part way, and I just kind of would like to go a little bit farther about the efforts at sustainability occurring at all levels, which you've been talking about, operations, management, employees, and customers. And I'm interested in the customers part and also the part on policy forums, what you're doing to establish policy in other places or with other... Yes, you tell me.
It's weird. I mean, as the chief sustainability officer, I feel like we always have like four audiences. And the first is, if we're going to be successful implementing a sustainability plan, that means a big part of that is reducing the impact of the company. So when we talk about how we work on sustainability with operations, that's everything from waste reduction to recycled materials in the product. It's educating our management teams about what are the right goals to set and how we'll actually implement them. On the employee side, some of it is educating the factory and sales teams on sustainability in general, but also teaching them kind of new ideas. The best example might be bringing biomimicry training to our employees and making sure that, you know, they have access to these new sources of information to do it more sustainably. But it's also about encouraging them to do stuff at home.
We find
that a lot of people who really have gone through sustainability learning at the business and are being asked to apply those principles in the factory often go home and it starts changing what they do at home. They start talking to their parents about it or their kids about it. So that's a big part of engaging our employees. And then our customers, a lot of it is really talking to them about the value of picking a more sustainable product. So, for example, many of the customers that we talk to now don't know that 40% of global carbon emissions are coming from the built environment. I think many of us who, like, in the built environment space, who make decisions either around building construction or the materials that they're going to building, have never really kind of come to grips with the fact that we build, like, a new New York City every month, and we're going to continue to do that for the next 35 years.
Oh, my gosh.
Based on, you know, data from kind of a global building index, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we haven't connected climate change and carbon emissions all the way down to the decisions in the built environment around what's the kind of steel that we're going to use in this building. How much concrete are we going to use? Can we get a low carbon concrete? Can we swap out wood for steel? What kind of glass are we going to use? What kind of flooring are we going to put in here? And all of those decisions add up in a really significant way. So it's our job as people who are making carbon neutral flooring products to help our customers understand it makes a difference to choose a carbon neutral flooring product. And more importantly, it makes a difference if every product you try to choose for a building is carbon neutral. And every construction material. And then maybe you try to make a net zero carbon building. And then your campus becomes net zero carbon. And then your city. It's really our job to make them understand what's at stake when they're making those decisions. And sometimes that means that education isn't just enough and we have to change policies. And so a great example of something that we're doing this year is in the state of California. Actually, in 2017, California passed this amazing forward-thinking piece of legislation called the Buy Clean Bill. And the Buy Clean Bill directs the state of California, when they're making decisions on new building projects, to consider the carbon footprint of the construction materials and to make better choices, because the state of California has said, look, lowering the carbon emissions of our state is a huge priority for California. So when we construct new buildings, new offices, we're going to think about the construction materials. We think they should go further, and they should also think about all the materials that go inside the building. So we've been working with the original sponsor of that legislation, and we've just introduced a bill this year in the California legislature to expand the Buy Clean program beyond construction materials to also include interiors materials, so that every time the state of California or someone in the university system is thinking about a new project, they think about the embodied carbon of the flooring and the ceiling tiles.
So that makes me think probably not, you're probably not, flooring and that sort of thing are probably not part of LEED standards now, but they could become part of LEED standards as people are thinking about new structures or renovations or whatever.
Yes. So currently, you know, LEED is a great example of a market mechanism that does acknowledge more sustainable products and low carbon products, but they don't go probably, LEED doesn't go probably as far as it needs to in terms of, like, the carbon footprint of certain materials that can be used on a LEED project. And just in November, they issued a pilot credit to LEED to actually address this. So they're starting to think about it, and they're starting to incorporate this idea of giving credit for lower carbon footprint materials that can go into projects. It's really in the early stages, but it's a really encouraging thing to see coming from LEED, because that is such a it's a really influential standard that people are using now, and so it's a really good step forward. But even without LEED, there are lots of, you know, private sector folks, there's lots of universities, there's lots of people who can do this without a LEED credit by just simply asking the people that you're going to buy a material from for the carbon footprint of the product. You know, you don't even have to have a lead system. It can be either written into your contracting or your RFPs, where you ask people to disclose the carbon footprint of the products that they're going to try to sell you. You could actually look at your current largest, like, top 10 suppliers that you do business with if you're a university or a large bank or someone in the tech sector, and you can actually send out a questionnaire and say to all of those suppliers, I just want you to calculate the carbon footprint of your products and let me know what they are so I can make a better decision.
I want to remind our listeners, this is Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico. We're talking with Erin Mizan. She's the Vice President, Chief Sustainability Officer for Interface, an environmentally focused commercial flooring company, doing amazing work. We're just dazzled by what you've told us in the first part of this interview. She'll be here on March 27th as part of the This Way to Sustainability conference, speaking at 9 a.m. And CSU Chico is working. It's got a new science building in the works that's aiming for zero emissions carbon neutrality. Hope you get a chance to look at it while you're here and see if we could make some changes to that project to make it even more carbon neutral.
So in our email communication, you said that the Interface was about to introduce a new project or a new plan, a new something?
Yes. So last Thursday, Interface announced its quarterly numbers from the end of last year. And as part of that announcement, we let everyone know that over the course of 2019, we made a $50 million investment in new technology and new materials within the company to be able to create carbon negative products.
Wow.
So these are products that go beyond neutral and actually store more carbon in their materials than they emit throughout the kind of measurement of all the materials and the manufacturing used to make them. So it's super exciting for us, and we're able to do it because of a couple really great things. The first is building on 20 years of manufacturing efficiency and sort of knowledge about incorporating recycled materials. We've been able to kind of install some new technology that, when combined with more recycled materials and new biomaterials, means that when we measure the impact of those products, they actually store more carbon than they emit.
Wow.
And so I think what is really interesting thing about this is we have a whole bunch of people in the built environment space and in the university sector and in states like California who are now trying to figure out, how do we build zero carbon buildings as a part of addressing global warming, right? Mm-hmm. How is it that we start to get the right kind of construction materials, the right kind of interiors materials? And what this shows to every other company is that it's possible.
Right.
Because in 2016, all we had were carbon neutral products. And we said, we're going to issue this new challenge. We're going to call it Climate Take Back. We're going to set a goal to be a carbon negative company. And the first thing that we're going to do is try to make a carbon negative product. So in 2017, we actually launched a prototype.
Nice.
We didn't have the supply chain. We couldn't produce the products globally. But when measured, it was actually carbon negative. So we knew it could work.
Wow.
The next year, in 2018, we commercialized the backing of that and said, okay, we have the supply chain in place. We're able to make products with a carbon negative backing. In 2019, we actually figured out the supply chain, installed new technology, invested in putting new biomaterials in the product. So this year, we can announce that we can make carbon negative products, and we can make the backings of those products. In most of our products around the world, we can make three different iterations of a carbon negative backing. So we're very excited that we think these kind of products will provoke our competitors.
Yes.
They'll provoke the rest of the built environment space to say, look, if this little company with 5,000 people can actually do this, what can we do?
So how do you get them? How do you talk to other companies and corporations and factories about what's possible. How do you spread this kind of effort?
And do you have trade secrets that you will not reveal?
Well, we do, so I'll answer the first part.
I'm being facetious there.
Yes, we do a lot of talking. We give interviews like this. We go and speak to universities. We talk at a lot of industry trade events where our competitors are and others in the built environment space are. We disclose a lot of information on the products on our website, and we share our protocols. We also do something called environmental product declarations, and there will be environmental product declarations on the carbon negative product. What that is essentially a nutrition label for the product. It tells you everything that's in it. It tells you the materials that we use, and it tells you the environmental implication of all of the things that are in it and the manufacturing associated with that product. So we have been very committed as a company to disclosing, not just so our customers know what they're getting, but so everyone else in the industry can actually see the pathway that we're following.
Wow, that's great.
On the carbon negative product that we are launching this spring, some of those do have patent protection on some of the raw materials.
Okay.
So we might use phrases like biomaterials, or we might use, you know, phrases like recycled content, or we might not tell people exactly the percentages.
I appreciate your candor in that answer. Yeah.
However, if competitors wanted to know that, we would be willing to license that formula to them.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
If they were able to sort of give us a little bit of, you know, a financial
scratch.
If they were able to kind of, if we were to able to find a way to kind of, you know, think about how we could license that, we're certainly open to that. And we acknowledge as a company that we can't be encouraging the industry to go carbon negative and follow us if we're not willing to share the roadmap.
Yes.
So we have to find a way to do that. And I would say through a lot of the disclosures, through a lot of the talks that we give, we're willing to kind of show people what the pathway is. And then when it gets down to kind of that real proprietary raw material, we definitely would be willing to engage in a more formal relationship with a competitor to share some of that either technology or raw material information.
Okay. You guys are my new heroes. This is just great. We've been talking with Erin Mizan. She is the VP Chief Sustainability Officer for Interface. Tell great stories. I just really appreciate the way you have given us this vision and the story of this vision. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. I've been incredibly lucky to work at this amazing company. And I think, well, we certainly have a lot to learn. We definitely have something that we can teach others as well. So I appreciate the opportunity to be on the show.
That's
great. Thank you.
You're listening to Ecotopia on KZFR. As you may have detected, that was a replay interview. We had a guest cancel at the last moment, so we replayed one of our all-time favorite interviews. There were a couple of references in there to the This Way to Sustainability conference. Don't take those dates literally. They were about a year ago. Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the Chico Certified Farmers Markets, featuring three markets in Butte County. Year-round Wednesday morning in Chico at the North Valley Plaza, Saturday year-round at 3rd and Wall in downtown Chico, and a seasonal market Tuesday mornings in Paradise. Chico's Certified Farmers Markets, connecting farmers and food lovers since 1980.
One morning I woke up and I knew it all. A new day, a new way, and new eyes for all. Lord, you're where I thought mine kept on.
legends of fables are able.
Been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR FM 90.1 Chico, listener supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Chico Certified Farmers Markets, featuring three markets in Butte County year-round: Wednesday morning in Chico at the North Valley Plaza, Saturday year-round at 3rd and Wall in downtown Chico, and a seasonal market Tuesday mornings in Paradise. The Chico Certified Farmers Markets, connecting farmers and food lovers since 1980. An announcement that bears repeating. I want to tell you that coming up at 6 this evening, it will be North State Give and Take. Bobby Tryon will be interviewing one of our favorite people who's been on Ecotopia many times, Alan Hawthorne from Friends of Butte Creek, and you can learn from him what's going on in creek preservation, the salmon counts, and so forth. And this Friday on the Peace and Social Justice program at 11:30, Reverend Jesse Kearns takes a walkabout to interview some local advocates concerning the future of the Comanche Creek Camp and the City Council's decision to rescind the 2018 housing crisis declaration. And Jesse will also be sharing some good news concerning the future of Stonewall Alliance in Chico. His walkabout should be especially interesting given the injunction that has been filed to prevent the city of Chico from immediately evacuating the residents of Comanche Creek. And that will be pending throughout this week. There may be countersuits, but for those of us who support homeless encampments, it was really good news that the legal services in Northern California filed this suit on behalf of 8 people who are camping at Comanche Creek at the moment. And following up on the city's continued refusal to supply a place for the homeless to live. There have been multiple opportunities, but our conservative city council, of course, 5-1, rescinded the housing crisis declaration, claiming that there are sufficient beds to take care of the homeless, all of which is not particularly true. So, Friday, Peace and Social Justice, 11:30. Coming up tonight, North State Give and Take, Bobby Tryon with Alan Hartorn with Friends of Butte Creek. Thanks for listening to Ecotopia. Please check out our website, ecotopiakzfr.com, where we post recordings of our recent shows, along with show notes. And we have a resources page, a gold mine for people doing research projects, with the links to many people that we have interviewed on this program. You can also send us emails, ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com. And we podcast now on Spotify, Apple, Google, and others. Thanks very much for listening.
You are the new day.
State Give and Take on KZFR 90.1 FM. My name is Bobby Tryon, and today I'm going to interview Alan Hartorn from the Friends of Butte Creek. Glad to have you on the show, Alan. Tell me a little bit about how you got involved with Friends of Butte Creek.
Actually, I've always been a trout and steelhead angler, and having Butte Creek in my backyard was always a bit of a fantasy, and I took advantage of it as much as I possibly could. And in 1995, I had just come back from fishing and thought to myself, gee, I haven't looked at the fishing regulations in quite some time. I should see exactly what the dates are for Butte Creek. And